Welcome to the Steroids Podcast with your host, Dan the Bodybuilder from Thailand. Boom! Boom! Let's get started here. The Steroids Podcast is brought to you by Ultimate Guide to Roids, 109-page ebook by Dan the Bodybuilder from Thailand. Now, for the first time in bodybuilding history, you have someone with no corporate interests and no obligation to please anyone, not walking on eggshells to not offend. Ultimate Guide to Roids gives you the information, the whole truth, not a full truth and a half truth, full truth. Ultimate Guide to Roids gives you the keys to the Lamborghini, gives you the information, and lets you decide what to do with it. It's a crime this information has been suppressed this long. Now let's get on with the podcast.
Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Podcast, which obviously involves steroids, since bodybuilding cannot exist without steroids. First question of the day is from Pete Espinola, who says, "Hey bro, could you please answer the question of how your life changed socially after the gear lifestyle? In Ultimate Guide to Roids, you said that you knew getting big was important to living the life that you wanted, and you found out that you were right." Okay. Yeah, so when I first started taking roids, I was 24 years old. I was still in university at that time because I started university late and I was a transfer student. And you know what? At that time, the things that were important to me in my life were things that were more worldly. And I definitely wanted to like have more like casual relationships and stuff. And you know what? Steroids helped with that. They helped with that. But on the other end of the spectrum, they did not help with meeting nice girls. So I would say that taking the steroids kind of made me go from being someone who nice girls liked to being someone who nice girls were kind of steering clear of, and more like, you know, bitches, girls who are not acting very nice. You might think of them as acting, you know, bitchy or something like that. Those kind of girls liking me more with taking steroids. So that's how it affected me with women. And for that time period, I guess that was a good thing. I guess that was what I wanted. And then the other thing is that your physical stature affects the way that people react to you. There's a lot of nonverbal communication going on. And I'm really sensitive to this because of living in so many different countries, that I'm very sensitive to nonverbal communication. And a lot of people that have only lived in one country might just be like sensitive to words, right? And maybe a little bit sensitive or subconsciously sensitive to nonverbal communication. But I'm very, very aware of it. And so I've definitely seen how people's physical stature affects every human interaction that they participate in. The more size you have, the more mass you have, the more people will just defer to you naturally. It's like a human instinct to like defer to like larger men. So that goes with like height, and it goes with like muscle. And like the more power and the more force that when people just see you, they see that you're capable of exerting. And it's like subconscious, you know, it's subconscious. They're not, you know, actually going through this thinking like, oh, I should defer to this guy because he's like stronger or taller or something like that. It's like subconscious, and people just have like an instinct. They don't have to follow it. But it's like a first reaction that is like an instinct in people. So like physical stature plays a large impact in the reactions that you get from people, your first impression, how people perceive you. And then another thing is that it's a deterrent for harm done to you. Because if you're going into a lot of situations where you're not really sure how it is going to be, you know, how safe it's going to be, and just when you're around people who might want to do you harm, the kind of people who want to do people harm are not looking for targets where that's going to be very difficult, where that's going to be, you know, a really hard thing for them. You know, if someone wants to do others harm, then they're looking for easy targets. And when you come walking by with looking like a bodybuilder, you don't look like an easy target. So there's like a deterrence with, like, you know, being harmed by malicious people. There's a deterrence to that. And as far as traveling, going to a lot of places, I've been to a lot of places, some of them safe, some of them not safe. Having that deterrence factor there, of course, a muscle doesn't protect you from a bullet. Absolutely not. Absolutely, it does not. But there's a deterrence factor there where people just, you're not an easy target. People who are looking to do harm to others are looking for easy targets. They're not looking to go through a large struggle. They're looking for easy targets. So it's a deterrent. And so that's I think those are a few different things, you know, that mattered to me a lot, especially when I was in my early 20s. You know, I'd say as I've gotten older, those kind of things are less important to me, but there's still some things there. And then the other thing is that, as far as now that I'm older, absolutely, I want nice girls to like me. You know, I'm not trying to get, you know, like these hot, stuck up girls or something, you know, that you know, I may have been interested in before. That's when you get older, that for a lot of guys, I think that kind of goes away. Like around when you like turn like 30 years old, you can kind of have like a shift where you feel like, I don't want to do this anymore. And you feel like you want to be around nice people. At least that's the way it was for me and a lot of guys I know. So hope I answered your question there. There's other things too. I mean, we could get into a conversation about it, but I thought I'd just touch on a few of the things there that people probably, because when you talk about gear with people and you talk about like what kind of social effects that it has on them, a lot of times the first thing that they'll respond to is, oh, women can smell the testosterone or something like that. And I don't agree with that. I don't think that taking testosterone makes your skin release scent things. Because a lot of times people will say like they can smell the tren or something. And just even saying this right now, I'm going to get like a big backlash on it. But what I think people, in my opinion, when people talk about that, like with women, what they're picking up on is that, again, these traits that the steroids make you exhibit more, like not caring about other people's feelings as much, like less empathy, and like a more strong body language, more dominant body language, and some jerk traits and stuff. And there's a lot of traits that make you, that I would say are supported by taking gear. They're not caused by taking gear, but they're supported, like your body language and your general attitude, your caring for, like your empathy. And when those go less, when those go down like that, yeah, I think the nice girls like you less, but the bitchy girls like you more. So when people say like, oh, they smell the testosterone, or they smell the tren or something. I don't think that it's your pheromones increasing or the amount of scent that you're producing changing or something like that. I mean, yeah, there can be some scent changes and there can be, like, you know, maybe stronger scent or something. But I don't think that's what that, in my opinion, that's not what women are picking up on. What they're picking up on is a change in the way that you behave. And it has to do with what you're conscious of, like how you're talking and stuff, but it also has to do with, like, nonverbal communication, body language, etc., that these steroids have effects on. And I think it changes the type of women that are interested in you, from more of the nice girls to the not so nice girls. And a lot of times the not so nice girls are more of the girls that are going for, like, a sexy thing. And so they may be, like, more coveted or something like that, or like people are really interested in that. So yeah, I do think that steroids can help with that. But then at the same time, I think that they have a negative effect on women who are nice girls liking you. I think that makes the steroids make them like you less. And so, yeah, that why I wanted to go over that was because people are always asking, like, you know, how do steroids affect you with women? And there's, like, a lot of stuff going on about that. The other thing is that the steroids make it so that you're putting all this time and effort and energy into you and into your body and everything. And so, and there's, like, a big ego component with bodybuilding. And so you have to protect that because you put, like, so much investment into your body and everything. And you feel, like, a psychological need to protect that. So the more involved you get with bodybuilding, the less chances you will be willing to take on having your ego hurt. So you're going to be less willing to take risks where, you know, like, you could get rejected by a woman or something like that. Because you've got to protect this whole thing that you've been building up, that you've been working so hard on. I know bodybuilders can relate to me when I say this stuff. I know you guys out there can relate to me, where you may have been more just, like, who gives a shit, or, like, happy-go-lucky and or something like that in talking to women, like when you were natural, and then after being on steroids for a few years, more like you don't do that as much. You're more like kind of like standing there or something, like trying to, you know, like there's a thing, like, with bodybuilding about, like, you want them to come to you because of the way you look. So you're kind of like reversing the tables, because normally women, you know, they're looking a certain way and then men are coming after them. So you're looking to, like, reverse that kind of stuff. So anyways, it just looking at bodybuilders in general, you know, there's it's a bit of a myth, or like even like a meme, you know, that getting into bodybuilding is really going to get you a lot of girls. You know, I think the most effective way to get a lot of girls with bodybuilding is to just cut. Just cut. Don't worry about the big muscles. As long as you can bench press 2 plates per side for 5 reps, like, that's enough. And if you just cut from there, you're going to have the body that women are more looking for. They're not looking for a big jack dude, really. Like this is like you can get compliments and everything, and like the more that you are, like, looking really big and looking really jacked, the more that, like, people are going to be looking at you, and just, like, in your daily life, like, the more people are going to be staring at you and shit, and kind of like, what is this freak or something like that, or like, what is this this thing that just showed up in my path, that kind of a thing. So like, wow factor, shock factor, people being like, holy shit, like, people noticing you and everything. Absolutely. The bigger you get, the more that happens. But as far as, like, women thinking you're sexy, you know, you don't want to have a lot of muscle mass. You want to be super cut, and you want to have, like, you know, some muscle mass, but really, like, not a lot, like not a lot. that there's going to be guys that are, you know, arguing for and against this. And, you know, there's going to be guys saying like, no, you know, like when I got more size, I got more women and something. And yeah, absolutely. There's like individual preferences and everything. But in regards to the masses, I think what I'm saying here is pretty accurate in regards to how the masses or the large percentage or the majority of people or the majority of women are going to react to you. So I'll just leave that now. You asked me, Espinola asked me this question about how my life was affected after roids. And I just kind of got the feeling that everybody wanted to hear about girls and women from that question. You know, that's the feeling I get. That's what you guys want me to spend a lot of time on that answering it. So I did. Robertson has a comment about Dorian Yates. Okay. Dorian Yates thinks he's better than absolutely everybody and knows more and is a special snowflake. He's not. He's a prick from Birmingham. That was a good one. So this is... I think that Dorian Yates was obviously a great bodybuilder and everything. Here's what I think about Dorian Yates' training method. And I think it's really good. But some people, I don't know if he's doing this, but trying to say like there's only one training method or something, like same thing with like Mike Mentzer, like of course there's not. And you know, they try to focus on like one method of getting to a goal. So they're saying like, you know, the goal is to be really good at weightlifting, to be able to do a lot of different exercises in the gym for a lot of sets and reps with a lot of weight, and for you to be like surpassing like the other gym goers. Like, you know, maybe there's some other bodybuilders in there who can do like you or some powerlifters, but like for the normal population, you're like not lifting what they lift. You've gone far and above that. You've surpassed that. And so that's called getting really good at weightlifting, being able to do a lot of different exercises for a shitload of sets and reps with a lot of weight, okay? That other people, it's impossible for normal people to do what you're doing commonly. That's called getting really good at weightlifting. And that is the goal as a bodybuilder, is to get really good at weightlifting. That's how you get big, and you use your roids and you use your diet to facilitate that with your training. And of course, your training is programmed for that too, to keep on progressing like that, getting a little bit better every single training session or week or however you have it programmed. But let me look at this question again. So Dorian Yates, he's saying like, okay, well, in order to do that, you have to take, you know, you have to do one set or two sets or something like that and like take it to absolute failure. Okay, that's one method of making progress on that getting good at weightlifting journey. But then there are other methods too. Like we know like a more volume-based approach results in gains in strength and more reps and everything, because Dorian Yates' thing is about progression. Dorian Yates' thing is about giving it your all like that for one set or two sets and then being better next time. It's not about giving it your all like that for one or two sets and then coming in next time and giving it your all like that for one or two sets and doing, but it's the same thing. And you didn't do more. And the next time, and then just being like, well, I gave it my all. And then being, that's not Dorian Yates' method. Dorian Yates' method is when you're doing it like this, you keep getting better. You keep getting more reps. You keep getting more sets. You keep increasing the weight, okay? And that is the thing that is important. It's not the method. It's not whether you're doing volume training or whether you're doing Dorian Yates or Mike Mentzer HIIT training. It's is your training resulting in you getting good at weightlifting? That is the goal. And any method that gets you good at weightlifting is a viable method, and it's a method that works and that you should follow. So that's why we get people who have had success with so many different training routines or ways of training that are radically different. But what is the common denominator between all of these guys. It's that they're really good at weightlifting. They're not the same at weightlifting as your average 24-hour fitness person. And you go into 24-hour fitness and you see what exercises, sets, reps, and weights people are using, the average person. So successful bodybuilders, as a rule, it's not the same. They're not doing that. They got good at weightlifting, okay? They're not using the same amount of weight. They're doing more reps. They're doing more sets. That, you know, or, you know, one of those variables or all at the same time. And so that's just the thing that you really have to keep in mind. And it's not a thing of like, oh, well, Mike Mentzer and Dorian Yates are right and Arnold is wrong, or Arnold is wrong and Dorian Yates and Mike Mentzer are right and powerlifters are wrong and whatever is wrong, right? It's not like that. It's not a zero-sum game like that where there's one winner and one loser. There are various methods of getting to the goal, which is to be very good at weightlifting. That's what creates a bodybuilder when with the right food and roids. To be very good at weightlifting creates a bodybuilder. And there are various methods to get there, to get very good at weightlifting. So I don't know if Dorian is doing this for marketing or if he actually believes that. I can't conceive that he could actually believe that his method is the only method that produces results. He must think that it's superior, though, I think, or like his preferred method. And it's a very good method, and it's a method that works very well. And I like utilizing it and utilizing things from it. But it is obviously not the only method to get to the goal, okay? That's what I think about Dorian Yates' training. Someone asks if I can talk about IGF-1 LR3. Okay, so IGF-1, again, the really important IGF-1 is the IGF-1 that is created inside of your muscle cells, and it can't be measured in blood serum because it doesn't get into the bloodstream. Okay, so your actual muscle cells manufacture that IGF-1 themselves, not your liver. So when you take growth hormone, it both stimulates your muscle cells themselves to create IGF-1, and it also stimulates the liver to create IGF-1. Okay, and so that liver-produced IGF-1 is the IGF-1 that gets into the blood circulation. And when you take IGF-1 LR3, long R3, it's a long-acting IGF-1 that is in your blood circulation. Okay, so you're getting this IGF-1 that is not the type that is like super valuable in bodybuilding, the intramuscularly created IGF-1. But don't get me wrong, there are definitely anabolic and growth effects and metabolism effects of taking IGF-1, of having systemic IGF-1 levels, such as from growth hormone, etc. But again, the cosmetic effects of this are pretty extreme. So when we're looking at these physiques that are modern bodybuilding, and they look like a refrigerator, they look like a square, they're 3D as fuck, but they look like some kind of Frankenstein or some kind of monster or something. It's definitely not a body that, like, the average person on the street would say, I want to look like that. You know, it's not like that. That, because the really good looking look, where you'll have people on the street being like, damn, I wish I could look like that. That's a steroid thing. But this modern bodybuilding look, where you just look, you look like a refrigerator, you look like some kind of alien out of a science lab, that is a growth hormone, peptide, insulin thing, okay? So when you're doing things like, you know, taking huge dosages of growth hormone, taking IGF-1, various types, taking a lot of insulin, the cosmetic effect that you're going to get to your body is going to be more of this modern bodybuilding look. And if you're keeping those peptides, such as insulin, growth hormone, etc., low and not relying on them or not using them at all, you're going to have more of this classic bodybuilding look. So classic bodybuilding did utilize low doses of growth hormone, about 4 IUs per day. But they did not use insulin, and they did not use IGF-1 LR3. So it really depends on what you're going for. There are, like I said, I mentioned, there are anabolic effects of systemic IGF-1, bloodstream IGF-1, not just intramuscular IGF-1. There are anabolic effects, and metabolism changing effects, etc. So nutrient partitioning. But the question of, would you utilize it? Well, if you're going for a modern bodybuilding look, the modern bodybuilders are using it. If you're going for a classic bodybuilding look, the classic bodybuilders did not use it in any dose. Okay, next question. Justin asks, what is the cosmetic effect of equipoise? Okay, so equipoise is not a steroid that comes in and blows you away. It's something that causes an anabolic effect in the body, a mild anabolic effect in the body. So it's one of these things, again, where you could say it helps other roids work better. Okay, so it facilitates nutrient partitioning. It's anabolic, it's androgenic, and it's a stimulant. And it really doesn't have estrogen effects. And so people will add it to a cycle, and the cycle's just better. It's like adding a little boost to the cycle. It's not some kind of like big thing. Like, it'll give you like some more increased muscle fullness. Like Primobolan, but not as much. You know, Primobolan gives like an increase in muscle fullness. Anavar kind of does too. And so equipoise can have an effect like that. I mean, testosterone can also have an effect like that. Testosterone can make you full as fuck. So equipoise is very similar to testosterone. And it does, you know, testosterone does, like, you know, when you're really pushing up the dosage, though, it can cause like more water retention. And equipoise doesn't tend to do that. So it's like when you add it to testosterone, equipoise with testosterone, you're like increasing the anabolic effect of your cycle. And you're doing that without like adding side effects, right? So you're not adding anything in where you're going like, damn, like I'm on something and like I can really see the effects of this. It's not like that. You're just adding something in and you're going to notice an increased facilitation of what you're doing. Some increased anabolic effects, a little bit better nutrient partitioning. Some stimulant effects help you train harder in the gym. And then just like the protein accumulating effects, which aren't really huge, but they're there. And so that's what you can expect when you're using equipoise. You can use it in basically any cycle because it works good cutting or bulking. And what it's going to do is it's going to make the other stuff that you're doing work a little better. You're going to be more anabolic. Okay? So it just like makes things smooth. And for guys that get really bad side effects, equipoise can be really good. So for guys that have like intolerable side effects to taking roids, but they really like they like don't care, and so they're going to do it anyways. Sometimes you see these guys with like horrible, horrible acne. And you're thinking like, oh man, like, you know, somebody's got to help you. You know, you can't be doing that, you know, when it's that bad, you know, because it's like these shock stories or whatever that they show you to try to make you not use it. But then there's guys in the real world who actually have this, and, you know, and they're trying stuff like Tren and everything or whatever. A lot of guys that are having those bad effects, you know, it'll be like some guy in his early 20s or something like that, who's kind of just like doing a shotgun method and it's like really blowing up in his face. And so for these guys, something like 500 test, 500 equipoise can be like really a great harm reduction. Like, it can really make a lot of these horrible stereotypical side effects not be there. And these guys that have this kind of experience with roids where they're getting like the worst side effects, like cosmetic side effects, it can be one that doesn't aggravate it for them. So equipoise definitely has a utility there too. in guys who are getting horrible, unacceptable side effects from roids and looking for like some way to like control shit, well, Equipoise can be a good option there. Okay. Travis asks, how do you program carbs for maintenance bulk on or off super subs? Okay. So let's say for bulk. So the carbohydrates are, they're really going to fucking facilitate muscle gains, okay? Because this insulin thing, okay? If you have a lot of insulin on board, you have a lot of growth potential on board. If you don't have a lot of insulin on board, you have extreme fat loss potential on board, okay? This insulin hormone is the thing that like controls whether your body is building or whether your body is cutting down. So that's why when you go from a bulk to a cut, the diet's fairly opposite for the average guy. When you're talking about guys on the extremes, guys with super fast metabolisms or guys with super slow metabolisms, you have to make modifications for these guys. But for the average person is what I'm talking about. So when you're bulking, yeah, you want to have like high insulin levels. So you want to be eating like carbohydrates frequently. Like the more your insulin levels stay up, the less breakdown of anything in your body is happening. It stops all of that. So as far as like guys who can't gain weight, well, what will help you gain weight better then? Well, having like more insulin in your system, because that will like, you know, put like the brakes on any kind of like, you know, negative with the energy intake. So eating frequent, like small frequent meals. Yes, that is good advice for bodybuilders. For bodybuilders who have a hard time gaining weight, small frequent meals. That is good advice because you're going to be causing insulin release with, you know, every time you eat with these small frequent meals, and they're going to be containing carbs. So you're going to be having insulin on board all day, which is going to be inhibiting any kind of like breakdown. So that's good for a hard gainer. And just in general, like when you want to get big, you know, not even for a hard gainer, but just for your average guy. I mean, if you want to do a clean bulk, then you should control your carbs. And, you know, even when you are bulking, you should try, you know, unless you are a serious hard gainer who cannot gain unless he eats carbs with every meal, you should preserve and value or cherish your insulin sensitivity even when you're bulking. And how that is done is by having one meal, or depending on if you're a really easy gainer, it might even be two meals without carbs during the day. And so that meal is either going to be the first meal or it's going to be the last meal, because when you're sleeping, you're not eating, and so your insulin levels drop. And what you want to do is you want to extend that time where your tissues are not being influenced by insulin. So that's why you extend that sleeping period with lack of insulin by removing carbs from the first meal or the last meal, which gives you this time of withdrawal from insulin, and the insulin receptor can resensitize. And you know, that has a big effect. Like as far as like staying lean when you're bulking, like, changing one of these meals, first or last meal, to no carbohydrates is going to have a good effect. But all the other meals should have carbohydrates if you're bulking. Unless you're a really easy gainer, then, you know, it may be that if you like gains fat so easy that like really like maybe the pre-workout meal, the intra-workout, the post-workout, maybe that's all you really can take in with carbs without gaining fat. Hopefully you can take in one more meal at least, you know, with carbs without gaining a lot of fat. But it really depends, you know, like from person to person, how you program carbs. But I gave you the basic rundown of it right there. Bookend asks, why don't you live in your home country? Okay, I talked about this a lot on my other podcast, which is on Spotify and iTunes and YouTube. It's called Grab the Bull Podcast. And that podcast, I got like a video version of that, right? And it's like talking about my life, like, you know, what I've been doing since I like left America and everything, and you know, like my story and everything. It's like a good like motivational story for people, because it's like a, you know, like if you listen to it, it will pump you up. You know, the Grab the Bull podcast, it will pump you up. So why don't I live in my home country? Because I feel like I really would like to live like a natural lifestyle that's in harmony with nature. And I don't feel like the Western civilization is in harmony with nature. So I really like the classic traditional way of living and the classic traditional family and everything like that. And modernity, I'm not a fan. And even when it comes down to things like houses, buildings, cars, I'm not a fan of modernity. I'm a fan of classical, and I'm a fan of tradition. And the Eastern countries, which I've had a tendency to live in, I haven't only lived in Eastern countries, but I've had a tendency to gravitate towards them. And the reason why is because they're still living a traditional life, and it's focused on families and things like that. It's, you know, it's in harmony with nature. I don't feel like they're fighting against nature. And a lot of times the countries don't have like weird things going on in them too. Like it's very obvious in Western countries that like there's a lot of like weird stuff going on, you know, like where you're like, you know, it's dysfunctional. Like in all levels, there's like dysfunction happening on, and it almost seems like programmed chaos. And it's like, you know, when I was 16, I was already thinking about how do I get out? Yeah, it took me until I was 25 to be able to start doing that. But I was already thinking about it, like at 16, like I got to get out of here. because I really like that traditional in harmony with nature lifestyle. And, you know, I grew up in California, which, you know, maybe I wouldn't have felt the way I did if I didn't grow up in California. You know, if I grew up somewhere else, but that was the way I felt. And as far as like seeing, cultures and stuff like in these other countries, man, like, you know, it goes something as simple as like seeing like an advertisement for a bank. And like when you see the marketing, the advertisement for the bank, it's like a husband and a wife and their daughter, and they're like staring off into the distance and like imagining like a home and a car. And like, so like that's what the bank is like trying to say, like, look, come to our bank. We're going to help you. You're going to help your family have like happy family time, right? So stuff like that. And I know that in the West, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 50s, it was like that. I know it was like that, but it's not anymore. And so I'm, you know, that makes me feel like grieving, you know, and it makes me feel like I'm like in some kind, yeah, you know, it's, that's very like, I guess you could say, offensive to me or something, that it's not like that anymore. And so I went out in search of that. Okay, next question. Bajarki asks, could you answer a question on the podcast? How well would clenbuterol work alongside norditropin? That would be what would be the best protocol? And since norditropin is a fat melter, would it be a turbo upgrade to put in clen? Or would it be a waste since HGH is already doing so much? It definitely would not be a waste. So clenbuterol is super strong fat burner. It's pretty much like equal with growth hormone and how good it is at doing that. And, you know, high dose clenbuterol is not needed. That's another thing, is that high dose clenbuterol is not needed. You know, 20 micrograms per day, 40 micrograms per day, those are effective doses. And if you cycle off of that after 2-3 weeks and you take 2 weeks off and then you start it again,
again, it's an effective dose, and you, and repeating cycles like that works. Some people like to keep upping the dose and not take breaks, and maybe they'll be on it for like 8 weeks or like 12 weeks. I don't like that because clenbuterol has serious mental side effects. It makes you seriously irritated, and can make you feel like mad a bit too, and like you cannot chill, because it activates your fight or flight response, and it's like the body part of your fight or flight response. So your body is just like ready to go all the time. And, you know, you might be able to like hear your heart reflecting like on your ear and your pillow when you're trying to go to sleep or something like that on clenbuterol. So, you know, it's a really nasty substance, but it's super effective for fat burning, and absolutely combining it with growth hormone is effective for fat burning. Norditropin, like you said. And again, I the same dosages that I was talking about, you know, like 3-4 IUs per day of norditropin and 20 to 40 micrograms of clenbuterol. And when you're not feeling it anymore, taking a break and then starting it up again. And then the other thing is that with clenbuterol, if you don't feel it, it's not real. So clenbuterol is like drinking coffee or something, you know, an hour later it kicks in. And you know, like if you don't drink coffee and then you drink coffee, you feel that, you know. And it's the same thing with clenbuterol. Like when you take that, when you haven't been taking it, you take 40 micrograms, you feel that. So if you don't feel anything and you've been taking it for a few days, it's not legitimate. So that's how to recognize that. But yeah, 20 to 40 micrograms per day. I would really not advise going over 80 micrograms per day. Just because, again, I think if you keep your tolerance down, you can stay on those safer therapeutic doses like are used for asthma, 20 to 40 micrograms. And, you don't have to like, you know, just beat on your system so hard with those high doses of clenbuterol. Okay. Next question. Okay. Welkybeak asks, question for the podcast. What do you think about generics and brand original medicines? Is there any significant difference between them? I have recently purchased Telmisartan because my blood pressure went up. Generics are much cheaper, but I heard that some people don't see any benefits from taking these drugs. I mean, they just don't work for them. What are your thoughts about it? Should we always try to get brand drugs? Love the podcast and really appreciate the honesty you put in all the videos. Regards. Yeah, so I think that it's a, you know, normally the brand name medications are a little bit better. Yeah, normally just anecdotally in general, but not all the time. Sometimes there is like amazing generics. And I'm talking about medicine, okay? I'm talking about medicine. Like we're talking about like ibuprofen. We're talking about like cabergoline, something like that. You know, a lot of times the generic medication is fine, okay? But the people who originally made it and made the chemical formula for it and made the procedure for making it, they've got a system going on there. And just there seems to be more consistency. So a lot of times in medicine, there is very good generic medicine available. But sometimes there's generic medicine that it just doesn't seem to pack the same punch as the brand name of the, quote, same chemical does. And that can be for various reasons. And I think the most likely reason is just the quality control process not being as high. And I really think that that's the main reason, is the quality control process not being as high. And so sometimes you just get lower quality stuff. Whereas with the brand name, they seem to have a track record of just in general having a little bit higher quality than the generics. But that's not a hard and fast rule. There's plenty of generic medicine. There's plenty of generic telmisartan that is totally able to hang with the brand name Telmisartan, other medications. Okay. Ortiz asks, Dan, I hope this message finds you well. I know you don't like peptides, as growth hormone has always been the go-to, but will you be able to shed any light on how to heal sports injuries? Shoulder pain most common. Thanks. Okay, yeah. I'm an expert on this. So if you go to a doctor in America with a sports injury, they're just going to be like, give you some pills or something, like ibuprofen or something like that, right? We already know that. Everybody's experienced that. And if you go to a chiropractor, they're going to be like, oh, your bones are out of alignment, okay? But why is it that they just ignore the muscles? And they're just like, there couldn't possibly be a problem with the muscles. There just couldn't possibly be a problem with the muscles. That's how they act. That's how medicine in the West acts. Okay, that is not how medicine in the East acts, okay? It's like tissue work, therapy, trigger point therapy, massage, active release therapy, stuff like this. It's big. It's big. And it's like a part of people's lives. Okay, so there's a cultural difference there where one side like seems to not accept that muscles can have problems. And, will basically ridicule you for having problems in your muscles, which is totally gaslighting you, because there are definitely problems that occur during muscles. And this is where these sports injuries come from. So when you ignore the cause of the problem, which is a dysfunction of the muscle, and you treat these other causes like the inflammation or the tendon or the joint, you're going to be pulling your hair out, because you'll never be able to solve the actual thing that is causing this issue, which is a problem in the muscle, okay? The muscle has trigger points, which are bands of taut muscle fiber that the resting tone, the resting amount of contraction or muscle tone that those fibers have is not good. It's not the way it should be. The tone is too high in those fibers, and it's causing the muscle to be tight, which is then pulling on the tendon, which causes the tendon to get inflamed, and the inflamed tendon causes the joint to not be in the right spot. So you have these downstream problems caused by an injury or a malfunction inside of the muscle. And these kinds of trigger points are very common. When you hear about a muscle knot is one of these trigger points, these tight, taut bands of tissue that have increased resting muscle tone or hardness, contraction in them, that are pulling things out of place downstream and putting pressure on other tissues downstream. This is where the cause is coming from, and the other things downstream are symptoms. And so whenever you have an injury, I had to work on this shit for myself because I had a lot of chronic pain. And so for years, for a long time ago, I was really working on this and figuring this stuff out. As you know, it's the same thing with me, you know, like going to the doctors and the doctors looking at me like I'm crazy or something, but there's definitely a problem, you know. It's them who are crazy. And so the solution to this is to get tissue work done. And all the professional athletes in the West are getting tissue work done, active recovery and tissue work. So while for the lay people, for the general people, it's not accepted, and it couldn't be that, well, the professional athletes are on this, because the people who are taking care of them know that this is important and that this works. So they are doing active recovery. They are doing tissue work. They are doing tissue therapy. They're getting massage. They're doing something like a ice bath. They're doing something like, whatever therapies, whatever soft tissue therapies they are, you know. You have stuff like ultrasound. You have stuff like laser. You have stuff like electrode therapy. There's tons of different therapies, okay? I'm just trying to give you examples of soft tissue therapy, okay?
But the one that really works the best is things that actually put pressure on the muscles. So cupping puts a outwards or a pulling pressure on the muscles, and like ART, active release therapy, or like deep tissue massage therapy puts a pressing effect on the muscles. Okay. And so these pulling and pressing effects, I think the pressing effect, the massage one, that's the best one. That's the one that really works, is pressure. Okay. And when these top bands, these trigger points, these top bands of muscle that have this increased resting tone, when they are pressed on like this, and I'm talking about very hard and direct pressure, you know, like with your finger or with like a pipe or something like that, you know, something that you can really get an exact press on and fucking put pressure on that point. And when you find one of these points in your muscles, you should keep the pressure there very hard for like 45 to 60 seconds, and the pain will kind of increase sort of like a roller coaster, but then it'll get to a peak and it'll start going down. And that's like how you give these things therapy, and you have to do it like a few times a day for, you know, maybe it's only 1 week, or maybe it could be 3 weeks, you know, it depends on how bad your thing is, you know, but you'll get instant relief from doing this. Instant relief. It won't be 100% healed, but there will be some improvement from doing this. And so whenever you've got an injury, like a joint injury, something like a shoulder injury, what you need to do is you need to feel around in the muscles that are near that joint, and you need to feel and press into the muscles and see if there's any of these tender spots, these tender sensitive spots that react when you put pressure on them. And if you react and you're like, oh shit, like that spot is so tender right there, that's the spot where you have to dig in, and you have to put yourself through that pain, put yourself through that pressure to destroy that trigger point. When you put so much pressure on it like that, it causes like a reaction inside of those cells, and it also causes like a restriction of some blood flow temporarily and stuff, and it has like a resetting effect. So you get this like reboot effect on the muscle fibers in that area, and there's a loosening effect, a relaxing effect, and eventually you can get that increased muscle tension to go away. Which will then, you know, your joint pain or your tendonitis or whatever, then that will also go away, because now the tendonitis can get uninflamed and the joint can get right back into the right place, because the thing that's causing this whole issue, this whole waterfall of downstream issues, the muscle, is now healed again. So yeah, again, like this is super important. This is so important because everybody who is a gym rat or more has like chronic pain. From lifting weights, it causes chronic pain. And so this thing where you feel around in your muscles, and if you have an injury specifically, if you feel around in the muscles on either side of that joint, looking, you know, so like if it was in my elbow, then I'd be looking in the muscles of my forearm, I'd be looking in the muscles of my bicep, and I'd be looking in the muscles of my tricep. And I'd be trying to find a tender spot that when I touched it, like radiated pain and was like, oh shit, putting pressure on that spot. And a lot of times it might even radiate pain like into the joint specifically that is hurt. And that's when you can tell for sure you're on it. You found it. You found the one that is causing the problem. And then again, you give yourself that self-therapy like I was talking about with the pressure on that spot causing the pain. So that's trigger point therapy, super important. A Theracane or a croquet ball or a lacrosse ball, foam roller. These are all ways, you know, a Theracane and a lacrosse ball or a croquet ball are like pretty extreme because it's like really hard. And those are what I use because they're like rock hard. And me personally, I got this, I've been lifting a long time. So I've dealt with this issue. And so I always carry a Theracane with me and a croquet ball because those are mandatory pieces of equipment for me, man. I can't even function without that, you know? I'll lock up without it. So those two, very good. They're the most intense, but also a foam roller, high density, hard foam roller is also a good method for working on this.
All right. So that's going to be the last question for the podcast today. It's fun talking to you guys, and I'll be coming up with another episode for you guys real soon here. So make sure to go pick up Ultimate Guide to Roids, 109-page ebook by Dan the Bodybuilder from Thailand. You know, if you just go to bodybuilderinthailand.com, it's I think it's the first article on the homepage where you can check it out and read like 20 pages. It's definitely worth it. It's my best content. You know, if you like the podcast, the book will blow you away.